So turn to that chapter that we read, 2 Samuel chapter 1, 2 Samuel chapter 1. So we're coming back tonight to the life of David. We've been just making our way, looking at his life, this man who is, we know, the Lord's anointed. He's been anointed many years earlier than this to be the future king. So God's purposes for his people, his purposes for us are bound up in this man. And yet he's a man that we can all relate to. We've seen he's a man with flaws. He's a sinner. And we'll see that perhaps even more in 2 Samuel, sadly. And yet he's a man after God's own heart at the same time. He's a man who loves God. He's a man who wants to follow God and walk in God's ways, and we've seen that as well. And we can relate to that, can't we? The inconsistency in our own lives, where we love the Lord and we want to follow him, and we come here on a Sunday and we know that we trust Jesus and we want to live our lives for him, and yet there's still such inconsistency. We fail and we fall short, and what a mix we can be, just like David. And so we're thankful, aren't we, that David is just pointing us ultimately to someone greater, to a better shepherd, a better king, to Jesus himself, who David needed and you and I need as well. Well, as we come back to the story then, we find David and his men, verse 1, back in Ziklag, in the land of the Philistines. You remember that David and his men had nearly ended up fighting with the Philistines against the people of Israel. I mean, they got themselves into a right mess. And thankfully, the Lord graciously had got them out of it, hadn't he? Because although Achish, one of the Philistine lords, had been very happy for David and his men to come with them into the battle, the other Philistine lords were not having any of it. And they send David and his men packing back to Ziklag. And it was a great mercy, really, from the Lord that gets them out of that. And yet you remember, having returned to Ziklag, full of relief, they discover that Ziklag has been burnt to the ground and their wives and their children have been all taken away captive. And they're crushed, aren't they? And we saw how David had to strengthen himself in the Lord his God. Really, the Lord uses that in many ways to bring David to his senses, doesn't he? And then in the mercy of the Lord, they go after the Amalekites who've captured the wives and children, and they defeat them, and they restore everyone's restored. It's an amazing mercy. The Lord enables them. They're all safely brought back. Not one of them is lost. And so now they're back at Ziklag. They've been back for 2 days. And on the third day, somebody arrives with news that's going to change David's life forever. David must have been wondering what's happening in Israel. What's happening with this battle between the Philistines and Israel? And he doesn't have to wonder any longer. So the first of our 5 points this evening, just as we make our way through tonight, is this: sad news, sad news. That's our first heading. That's verses 2-4. So on the third day, David is in Ziklag, and this man comes from the battle. We're told his clothes are torn, he's got dust in his hair, the sign of a bearing bad news, and he comes to David and he falls on his face before him. And so David asks where he's from, and when he says he's come from the camp of Israel, David then asks news from the battle, and we get this reply in verse 4. Look at the second part of verse 4. The people have fled from the battle, many of the people are fallen and dead, and Saul and Jonathan his son are dead also. Now, of course, that's news that as readers we already know. We know that from the last chapter of 1 Samuel. And it's actually just important for us, because of what comes on in a moment in chapter 1 of 2 Samuel, just to go back to chapter 31 of 1 Samuel and remind ourselves of some of the details of that chapter. So just turn back to, you might not have to turn the page, but 1 Samuel 31. So this is the battle now. We're taken back. We've already been in the battle. We've already seen what's happened. And so the scene is Mount Gilboa. We see that in verse 1. The men of Israel have fled from the Philistines, verse 1, and a chase ensues with the Philistines following hard after Saul and his sons. And then verse 2 of chapter 31, the three sons are killed. So Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua are killed. Then verse 3, the archers... Saul is hit by the archers. He's seriously wounded. And then let's just read from verse 4 of chapter 31. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised men come and thrust me through and abuse me." But his armor bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. Therefore, Saul took his sword and fell on it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died with him. So Saul, his three sons, his armor bearer, and all his men died together that same day. So there they are. We have that tragic end of this tragic life. This man, I mean, Saul was a tragic character. He had such potential. He had, you know, he had many strengths, really. He did bring some good to the land, as we'll see when we think about David's lament. But he fundamentally was flawed. He just wouldn't obey the Lord, and he wouldn't humble himself before the Lord and obey his word. So he's rejected, isn't he, by the Lord. Not out of spite, but because he has rejected the word of the Lord. And there's an irony, actually, as the chapter opens, because you remember what was the sort of crunch point when the Lord rejects Saul? It's when Saul fails to kill off all the Amalekites, isn't it? You remember the Amalekites have been the descendants of Esau, and they try to attack the Israelites on the way out of in the wilderness, and so God has a judgment on them. Says to Saul, "I want you to kill off all the Amalekites." He doesn't do it. That's his disobedience. And here's an Amalekite coming to give the news of Saul's death. There's an irony there, isn't there? So 2 Samuel opens with this sad news coming to David. And we're reminded once again, as we start this next book, as it were, although in many ways it's just one book, isn't it? But we're reminded of the folly of disobedience. We're reminded of the tragedy of a life that's just won't submit to the Lord. And Saul dies, doesn't he? And he dies alone, he dies lonely, he dies afraid, and he dies without hope. And so it's just good for me to remind us all tonight, we're all going to die. Unless Jesus comes first, we've all got to die. And we die alone and lost and without hope, or we trust in Jesus Christ, and then because he's conquered death, we can die with hope, can't we? We can die with confidence. And it all hinges, doesn't it, on will we trust? Will we humble ourselves? Will we trust and obey? Because Saul wouldn't, ultimately. For all his words, he wouldn't really trust and obey. So it's sad news. It's sad news. It's a tragedy. It's a tragedy. So we've got sad news. Then secondly, we've got lying lips. Okay, that's verses 5 to 10. Verses 5 to 10. So when David hears the news of Saul and Jonathan's death, he wants to know more. How does this Amalekite know? Well, the Amalekite begins to tell his story. Look at verse 6. The New King James puts it like this. "As I happened by chance to be on Mount Gilboa." Now, that all starts rather suspiciously, doesn't it? What was the Amalekite doing in the battle anyway? And so he tells me how he's come across the dying Saul, who's alone and not quite dead, and he asks this man to finish him off, which he's done, and then he's taken his crown and his bracelet, and he's brought them to David, and he's called them "my lord." Now, that account does not tie up with the account back in chapter 31, does it? We're told, aren't we, that Saul fell on his sword and he died. His armor bearer saw that he died, and he killed himself. And then the divinely inspired author sums it up, doesn't he, in verse 6. So Saul, his three sons, his armor bearer, and all his men died that same day. So who are you going to believe? Are you going to believe the divinely inspired author, or are you going to believe this Amalekite? One of the commentators says, I put it like this, a good general rule is never trust an Amalekite. Never trust an Amalekite. And this one is proving very untrustworthy. I think he's lying, isn't he? Very much seems that way. Why? Well, we're not told for sure, are we? But the sight of him prostrating himself before David and calling him my lord and bringing him the king's crown and bracelet at least suggests, doesn't it, that he's hoping for something, isn't he? In all likelihood, he's hoping for some rewards from David. I mean, after all, bringing David the king's crown and bracelet, having finished off Saul, oh, those things are going to please David, aren't they? I mean, this is his enemy. Certainly, that's what lies behind lots of lies, isn't it? Just the desire to look good. The desire for some reward, even if it's just the reward of looking good and others being impressed by you. I mean, there's nothing like, you know, adding to a story a bit, you know, weaving yourself into the storyline, making yourself look good and important, adding a bit here and there. And yet those things often come back to haunt. And that's certainly true here, isn't it? It's certainly true for this man. I mean, he's going to find out in the most serious way. Little does he realize what David is going to think of him finishing off the Lord's anointed. He's going to be judged, isn't he, by the Lord. I mean, I don't know what you think of what David does, but I think it's judgment from the Lord. And you might go, well, that's a little bit Old Testament you, isn't it? But then we could go to the New Testament, can't we, into the book of Acts. And we discover there what God thinks about lying in order to make yourself look a bit better. And we see, don't we, in Acts chapter 5, Ananias and Sapphira, they do exactly that. I mean, they sell some land. They didn't have to do it, but they did it. And they didn't have to bring all the money to the Lord. And they didn't want to bring all the money to the Lord, but they wanted it to look like they brought all the money to the Lord. And so they make up a story, don't they, that they've sold the land for so much and they've given it all to the church, all to the Lord. And right at the beginning of the New Testament church, the Lord wants to make clear what he thinks about lying lips. And Peter doesn't have to go to somebody, go and slay them, does he? Because the Lord does it himself. So we're reminded, aren't we, of what the Lord thinks about lying lips. And you know, we can go, oh, well, yeah, that's an Amalekite. I mean, you know, you never know what Amalekites are going to be like. But, I mean, David's not long got out of a complete mess from lying lips, hasn't he? He's been telling Achish the whole time. He's been going off and fighting against the land of Judah and the people of Judah, whereas he'd been fighting against the people around, hadn't he? And we're just reminded, we've got to be careful about lying lips, about exaggeration. It's a temptation, and of course, even if we can hide it from other people, we can't hide it from the Lord. Is there some lie that you're living at the moment? You all look very respectable. But let me just ask that question. Is there some lie that we're living, something that we're hiding away, some story we're telling? Who knows? So we've got sad news, and we've got lying lips, and we've got, thirdly, real grief. Real grief. That's verses 11 and 12. Forgive me for just reminding you once more what David has suffered from Saul's hand. I mean, we've seen it, haven't we? And this will be really the last time. But David had, of course, come to the fore by killing Goliath. He'd saved Saul and his nation and his rule in that moment. It'd been a moment of great bravery and loyalty on David's part. And rather than being thankful, Saul has become jealous, hasn't he? And so jealous that he can't stand the sight of David any longer. And David has to flee from his home and is forced to live on the run. And Saul has made many attempts to take his life. Just to remember that. He's pursued him relentlessly, hasn't he? So that in the end, David has basically reached breaking point, hasn't he? And he's fled from his own land, and he's living in the land of the Philistines. Saul has basically tried to destroy him. He's spoken evil of him. He's tried to do evil to him, and all in the face of nothing but loyalty from David. And let's be honest, David is not going to be able to rest until Saul's out of the way. And so how would you imagine David would respond when he hears news that Saul has died? The man who's just ruined his life and shown him nothing but evil. Well, surely you'd expect at least some measure of relief, if not joy and gladness. I mean, I think that's what the Amalekite was expecting. I think the Amalekite was expecting a party, wasn't he? But there's none of that, is there, from David? Instead, we see here genuine sorrow and grief. So here he sees the king's crown and the king's bracelet. And we read in verse 11, then David took hold of his own clothes and tore them. And so did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and they wept and they fasted until evening for Saul and for Jonathan, his son. So what an amazing example of loving your enemies. I mean, we don't read anywhere, do we, of David speaking ill of Saul in spite of all his bad treatment. And there seems to me to be a genuine love for Saul. He's grieved that this has happened to him. And I want to remind you tonight, brothers and sisters, that we are called to love our enemies. Can you turn with me to Luke chapter 6? I mean, it's just one place we could go to. Luke chapter 6, verse 27 and 28. Let me just read those two verses. This is Jesus speaking. But I say to you who hear, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. And pray for those who spitefully use you. So that's what we're called to do, to love our enemies. Who are our enemies? Well, what does Jesus say there? We could just go through those two verses. Those who hate you, that's an attitude, isn't it? Those who just don't, just who despise you. Those who curse you, verse 28. And that's speech, isn't it? Those who speak against you, who gossip about you, who run you down. Pray for those who spitefully use you. So that's action. So we've got attitudes and words and actions. Those who are against you. Those who do nasty things. Those who try and run you down. That's who he's speaking about here. And those are the people we're called to love. I mean, he says a bit later on, doesn't he? In Luke 6, you know, if you love people who love you, well, that's all right, but that's nothing, is it? I mean, don't expect a medal for that. The Gentiles do that. But love your enemies. Love people who abuse you. Love people who speak evil of you. Love people who despise you. That's something else, isn't it? And that's what we're called to. And that's what we see with David. We see genuine grief and genuine love. Now, are we like that? I mean, the tendency is if there's somebody who's sort of done something to us and upset us in some way, and then we hear something bad's happened to them, we sort of, you know, the temptation is to say, well, serves them right. But David's not like that. And we're not to be like that. Because God's not like that. Verse 36 of Luke 6, therefore be merciful, just as your Father also is merciful. I mean, God loved us when we were enemies. And we're to display that too. Go back to our passage now. David and his men, don't just grieve for Saul and for Jonathan, who we'll return to in a while, but also look at verse 12, for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they've fallen by the sword. So they're grieved for the whole nation, aren't they? I mean, just think about it. These men themselves, David and his men, I mean, they've just had good news, haven't they? They've just got out of a battle. They've just won a great victory themselves. They just received their wives and children back. I mean, they're in party mode, aren't they? You know, in themselves. Life's good for them. But they're still grieved, aren't they? For Israel and what's happened in Israel. And it reminds me of, you get those characters, don't you, a bit later on in the Old Testament. You get Nehemiah, cupbearer to the king. doing well for himself in Babylon, and yet when he hears about the broken down walls of Jerusalem, he's grieved, isn't he? He weeps for a week. Or you got Daniel, don't you? He's the prime minister. He's dealing with the affairs of state, and yet three times a day he opens his windows towards Jerusalem and prays for that praise and its restoration. And it just made me think, well, that's what we should be like. I mean, Lord, here we are in our situation, and with so many blessings, aren't we? We meet freely, we have plenty, and yet we hear of brothers and sisters, don't we, in other places where they've got nothing, or they're persecuted, or they're imprisoned. And our hearts should mourn for them, shouldn't they? And we should be grieved for our brothers and sisters in such places. Okay, so we've got sad news, and we've got lying lips, and we've got real grief, and we've got gracious words, haven't we? So that's verse 17 to 27. So David writes words after Saul's death. And we're sort of, you know, humanly speaking, you'd be holding your breath, wouldn't you? What's he going to, you know, let me set the record straight. Let me tell you what Saul was really like. And yet that's not what we have at all, is it? We've got this lament that David writes, this poem of grief over Saul and Jonathan. And we look at verse 18. It's something that David wanted to be taught to the children of Judah. He wants people to know these things about Saul. Now, if someone's, you know, let's be honest, if someone's grieved us or done something against us, what do we want everyone to know? We want everyone to know what they've done. We want everyone to know, do you know what they said about me? Do you know what they did to me? Do you know how they left me out of this or didn't do that for me or did this against me? We want people to know that. David's the opposite of that. He doesn't say anything about any of those things. He writes a lament. And he wants it known and he wants people to sing about it. And he doesn't want Saul or Jonathan to be forgotten or what's happened to them to be forgotten. Actually, it's interesting that it's called, in verse 18, the Song of the Bow. So it's a song about war and about, it's a song maybe for war. Some of the commentators think this is a song that they would then sing as they went out to battle, as they thought about battle, a reminder of what the Philistines have done, because then if you're reminded of what they've done in the past, that might make you fight a bit harder. I mean, sometimes we do need to be reminded of past defeats that might make us more determined not to let them be repeated in the present. Well, it's challenging that David wants these things known in Israel and sung about in Israel, even though this is Saul. So he writes this lament for Saul and for Jonathan. And as I say, it could be a car crash, couldn't it? It could be just David spewing out, let me tell you what he's done. And yet, well, he says some lovely things about him. Look at verse 19. He says, the beauty of Israel is slain on your high places. He's speaking about Saul there. You remember, if you go back to 1 Samuel, when Saul comes onto the scene, we're told that he was tall and he was the most handsome person in Israel. And now he's fallen on Mount Gilboa. David, verse 19, places Saul among the mighty. He was mighty. Look down to the end of verse 22. The sword of Saul did not return empty. Though he died, he was a mighty warrior and he won great victories. Well, look at verse 23. Saul and Jonathan were beloved and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. So again, there's much negative that David could say about about Saul, but he doesn't say it and he doesn't want to say it. He remembers that there were good things to say. So he says of Saul and Jonathan, they were beloved and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. Jonathan wasn't just faithful to David, actually, was he? He was faithful to his father as well. An incredible way. David speaks about them being swifter than eagles and stronger than lions. And he calls, doesn't he? Look at verse 24. The daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you with scarlet, with luxury, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. So they've lost one who clothed them with scarlet. Clearly acknowledging, isn't he, that under Saul, they had some prosperity. They, you know, some things had gone well. And so David is very gracious, I think, in his lament for Saul. When you think what he could have said, and he doesn't say it, and he says kind words. And yet, we could say, couldn't we, for all those gracious words, there's something missing. Something is always missing when you're talking about the life of an unbeliever. When you've said the best you can think of saying, there's still an emptiness, isn't there, about it? You know, crying out from these words is, yeah, but what? What? Yeah, he was strong, he was brave, he was fast, but where is he now? What good is that now? I mean, that's the case, isn't it? You hear an obituary of somebody who's died, and lots of good things might be said, but you just think, yeah, but where are they now? What good is that now? I wonder what people will say about you and me when we've died. Will there be something? Will there be some hope to speak about? Some confidence of something beyond this world? One last thing, and then we'll be done. Great love, verse 25 and 26. Let me just read those verses again. How the mighty have fallen in the midst of the battle. Jonathan was slain in your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You've been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was wonderful, surpassing the love of women. How the mighty have fallen, the weapons of war perish. So we've watched on, haven't we, with admiration, and wonder, this amazing friendship between these two men. They should have been enemies. I mean, everything was against them getting on. So Jonathan's father Saul was, David was his enemy. Jonathan was in line for the throne, and yet the Lord has given the throne to David. And yet, the first time they met, they're just bound together, aren't they? They're just knit together. They're just brothers. And there's this wonderful, wonderful friendship between the two of them, where they care for each other and they covenant together. We've seen it, haven't we? They look out for each other. They speak for each other. They talk to each other. They encourage each other. And David said, this is the most wonderful love I've known. That's what he means when he says, doesn't he? Your love to me was wonderful, surpassing the love of women. There's nothing sexual about that. It's just, he's saying this was the deepest friendship I've had. And what lies behind it? Well, a joint love for the Lord. That was very clear, isn't it? That if we can use New Testament language, they were brothers in Christ. And they loved the Lord together, and they wanted to serve the Lord together, and their love for each other came from that. And there's that servant-heartedness in them. And we've faced the challenge of that as we've gone through David's life so far. And I want us to face the challenge of it this evening, that friendship. And that should be true of us as a church and people, that people should, you know, that if you'd have seen David and Jonathan, you think, this is the most surprising friendship ever. It can't be explained in human terms. And that should be true of our friendships and our love for each other as well, that people who come in and see that should say, well, this is amazing. This is I can't explain this, that these people are committed to each other and they serve each other and they love each other and they encourage each other. And what's the cause of it? Well, the cause of it is that they love the same Lord and they're concerned for the same ends and the same Savior. So it's an interesting chapter to start 2 Samuel, and yet it's still got things to teach us. That call to gracious love, loving our enemies, being wise with our words, and great with our love for one another as well.